The question of the blood on Mary
Beckney's, Mary Jo's blouse is a very interesting one. There were four responsible men who saw that blouse prior to her body being shipped to Wilkes-Barre. The first was the scuba diver who took her out, got her back out of the car and brought her up to the surface. The second was the chief who held her for a few moments in his arms before transferring her to the boat, which was then, her body was then moved over onto a police stretcher on the shore. The third would be the medical examiner, the doctor, associate medical examiner, Dr. Mills, who turned her over and saw no blood. None of these three men have seen blood on the blouse as of now, which is about 9:30, is when he performed his examination. And the fourth is Fry, Eugene Fry, the mortician, who undressed the body and prepared it for shipment to Wilkes-Barre. Now, those four men, if any of them had seen blood on that blouse, it would have been obvious that they would have said something about it. It wasn't until about a couple of weeks later that in the state police lab, the chem lab, that the blouse was subjected to a benzedrine test, and the blood was found very strongly on the back of the inside and the outside of the collar. It was a long sleeve blouse. A great deal of the back showed residual traces of blood, is what the term is, and down both arms.
And wasn't there some suggestion even of a possible strangling that they didn't investigate that?
The court record of the exhumation hearing, Denise brought that up three times.
Yeah. You see,
he thought that perhaps that blood might have come from strangulation, I think.
I think that it's very...
Again, this is opinion on my part.
Yeah, well, I think that it's very important when you've had so many tragedies in that particular family, and this last member of the family, the male, believes that they will get him, that you have to go for motives. And it would be very simple to do an autopsy. Well, it'd be simple for me. They wouldn't do it. They wouldn't allow it, whoever the they is. But Mary Kopechne should have been examined in the form of an autopsy to see, number one, if she was pregnant, because a lot of people would think she was expendable, maybe in the career of Senator Kennedy or smearing him. I don't think he would put himself up to this, but you can't rule out motives in any particular murder. And also, they should have gone into the belly for crystals to see if she was poisoned or drowsy,
right,
if any foreign thing was in her stomach to make her drowsy. If the report in a simple thing like Time Magazine picks up somewhere that she was drowsy in the back of the car at this hour and that he drove off and didn't know she was in the back, you have to see.
We don't know whether Time Magazine picked it up or made it up.
We don't know, but I don't think, as long as they're publishing it for the world to see why it shouldn't be checked out, it's a simple ABC of criminology to find out why what was in her belly. I should think that every avenue should be explored, and particularly after the blood was noticed.
The alcoholic content of the blood was almost to the level where she could have been termed legally intoxicated.
You see, it's very like in the killing of Officer Tippett. In order to have an excuse to arrest Oswald on some charge, there was no autopsy on Tippett, and you know he was sent to Parkland Hospital dead on arrival, and then he was sent to another hospital dead on arrival. Did you know he was sent to two hospitals?
Officer Tippett
was dead in two different hospitals and dead on arrival at two places, and the autopsy wounds should have been discussed to see if, from the window where Oswald stood, if he actually killed Officer Tippett, because many witnesses saw two people do a crossfire and flee. And therefore, any kind of rumor could easily be settled about whether Oswald killed Officer Tippett or not by doing an autopsy. There was none done.
Right.
And to perpetuate, you begin to know a pattern. You see, like people back there, accept these stories, or people out here accept these stories because they're not into the details of the other murders. You know, when we met, you said to me, how can you do work on Chappaquiddick in Carmel, California? How can you do your research
right,
so far away?
Right.
And I said, well, how can Mr. Justin in Germany write about every week from Germany? How can I call Denise and tell him to fingerprint the steering wheel he wasn't driving the car? It's easy, because if you've done enough research and cross-filed all the previous murders and assassinations in a systematic way, you come up with columns, it's like having a certain problem in arithmetic. How can you do this addition problem? Well, if you've done all the others, you can solve this one. Mm-hmm. The patterns are the same. And you know what to look for. And when you know that they don't look for it, that becomes a pattern, too. And it has become more than gross negligence. Just like the restructuring of your bullet and your flight path. The same mishandling of information that would be very simple in any other homicide isn't even scratched upon.
None of them have been, actually.
No. So we talk about Mary Kopechne with the blood on her blouse. What do you think?
And no other... The only other wound that she had was a small abrasion to one knuckle on her left hand. The fact that she went off supposedly in the death seat, as you know, the passenger's position in the front seat is supposed to be the most dangerous. She allegedly went off the bridge in the car, sitting in the front seat, passenger side.
Allegedly,
she did not go off the bridge, sitting in the front seat. Passenger side. She was in the back seat.
There is no way that she could have ever gone from the front to the back.
If you can consider that upside down in the dark, you have to go over the top of the back seat, of the front seat. In order to do that, you have to dive because the car was completely upside down.
Well, you had the feeling that the windows were smashed when the car was turned over and
No, before.
Before. But you had the feeling that she could have been dead and that they put her through that window if she wasn't in there before. Oh, you thought she was scratched by the glass?
She died of asphyxiation.
Yeah.
Not asphyxiation by immersion, which was the associate medical examiner's finding. He said that it was a simple drowning case. Drowning means asphyxiation by immersion.
Uh-huh.
She was found in a vertical position with her head way up into the
air pocket
in the footwell with her nose and mouth up. Uh-huh. Pointing towards the top of the pond, which was only about 2 feet above her nose,
where the air was. Yeah.
Where the air was trapped in the footwell of the car, which was upside down.
Uh-huh.
Now she died of asphyxiation,
uh-huh.
not by asphyxiation, by immersion. There's a very, very subtle difference here, and as a matter of fact, a great deal of the testimony at the exhumation hearing was between experts. Which was it? Was it asphyxiation by immersion, or was it asphyxiation? And they came out a draw.
Of course, they had to come to a draw, because if he had reported it earlier, she might have lived, and there was this problem,
that
too.
That was the basic problem that they were fighting in the exhumation report.
Holding on to Kennedy's responsibility.
Exactly.
Otherwise,
because if they had proved that he should have, if the scuba diver could have gotten there, let's say, within an hour of the time that car went off the bridge, it's very possible that she'd still be alive.
And the lights across the street and along the way were on, and and the fire station was across from the cottage.
Right.
You know, it all comes up. Another thing is that if he had been charged with murder, you know, and they proceeded with
this
that, then he might have exposed the people who dunked him, you know, by keeping that charge down and rearranging your evidence again and playing with words. Of his responsibility.
So it wasn't
the
murder as long as he just drowns, you see. This is the whole problem.
It couldn't be a murder. That's right.
I mean, that was what it was made out to be.
I think one of the important things to go to is the discrepancy of the car, too. It's an absolute... Mr. Look, why don't you explain...
Oh, the 85 minutes.
Yes, when Mr. Kennedy said he was leaving the cottage, and what happened?
Well, what happened was that his testimony, the senator's testimony, is that he left at 15 minutes after 11... and immediately drove down and drove off the bridge. Now, that means that the accident must have happened about 11:20, maybe 11:25. But it so happens that Christopher Look, who was a deputy sheriff at that time, he's now been elevated to sheriff, by the way, saw the car at 11:45 at the crossroad where the turn had to be made to the right in order to go down the bridge. Now, there's an hour and 25 minutes in there that is absolutely unaccounted for, and this has never been properly explained.
Well, he not only saw it, but he stopped to see if these people needed help.
He recognized it, right.
He recognized the car and the...
He recognized it the next morning as soon as it was being
thrown out. And he identified the license plate number.
He identified it sufficiently so that it was obvious that that was that license plate.
And in the front were two men and a girl.
In the front, he saw two people in front. And a something behind. He
something
didn't know.
Behind, yeah. But he saw two.
A shadow affection is what he
now
used.
Now, this is way after when the Kennedy accident would have happened.
An hour and 25 minutes.
An hour and 25 minutes, and he identified the car. You see, it, in reconstructing what could have happened, because people want alternatives, I think you do too, that it's possible that he left the party at 11 o'clock, and a person could be behind him and hit him on the head and give him a concussion. Take him over in another car to the inn.
Right.
And take care of him.
Right.
Then
just stand guard right there and be sure he didn't come too.
That's right. Then when they came back to the island or didn't have to return, because you could use many people in this kind of ambush kind of accident, this particular vehicle of his is left on the road then, and it was seen later and then thrown into the water.
Right.
Like you say, the window smashed or just turned over.
It drove itself off.
Drove it. Can you drive it? Is there a way to fix the car that it would go over?
It would seem it would be very simple to secure the wheel with a line, and actually there was the exterior mirror post was, one of the bolts was broken on that. There's no reason for that to be broken if it was just a simple going off the bridge into the water, because that was on the upside of the car when it turned.
Well,
so the theory has to be, and let's say one of the simple explanations is to secure the wheel and then accelerate the car, jump out the other side, slam the door, and that's it.
You see it in trick movies or stunts. There's no reason why it can't be done.
Stuntmen can handle that
all the time.
Very easily.
Very easy. And then she's in back, you know, asleep and out.
Right.
You know, and
Unconscious,
and the car goes over. And
flips.
And he's over at this particular place and wakes up and says, "What time is it?" And is scared, and is in his concussion. He's been hit on the head. And he comes down, identifies himself, goes up, goes down for breakfast, and goes back. And then he is told by the two lawyer men, one of his cousins, in the morning what happened. And then he goes to the police, you know, to see what happened there. And they have to reconstruct this whole story.
He and Markham reconstructed.
Reconstruct the whole thing. They're lawyers and cousins, and then they call Burke Marshall, who comes down, and then the U.S. government man who locks up the archives, you know, so that we can't
Same
have
thing.
Access to
right.
the John Kennedy
now at
murder.
Yale University.
I think that Burke Marshall has to be his babysitter. I refer to him on the program. Each one has his own babysitter, either the intelligence agency or a group that keeps control of what is said or done, and very tight control. Burke Marshall comes down there. And then all the stories are rewound and woven up, like now the ITT story is being reconstructed, and the new memos found and all these things. They rewrite the story to fit everything later. And then they get their heads together and go to Hyannisport, and the whole team. Who was over there having their conference? The whole gang, wasn't it? Who the 10?
Oh, yes. At Squaw Island, yes.
Yeah, who came over to that meeting?
McNamara and Sorensen are two of the names that occurred to me right away. And Marshall was there.
Did Schlesinger show up?
I'm not sure about Schlesinger.
Yeah, they had their.
That was in time, and I figure that those people probably are correct.
They had their powwow, and then they decided how it would fit.
Right.
And
let it loose on Friday night.
And everyone at the cottage, the girls were just simply flown out of town. They're back to their
place.
They
left the ferry. Left on the ferry that afternoon. Saturday afternoon.
No questions. No autopsy. No explanation of why the car was seen an hour and a half later.
That didn't come out for two or three days.
And Rosemary Keogh's purse was in the car. She didn't drive over with the senator. One of the girls.
No.
Her purse was in the front seat of the car. And the girl who was going back, supposedly, to get a rest and go back to the motel early, Mary Capetney, her purse was back at the cottage. Most girls travel with the key to their room and their lipstick
Usually.
And makeup, their personal belongings, you know. And that's back at the cottage. And she's supposed to be leaving there to go across the from the island. And the purse of another girl who wasn't in the car, supposedly, was found.
Right.
There was the same mishandling of all the evidence. It wasn't just one item. It was the whole...
There was an awful lot of confusion.
And the confusion of the testimony of
the people. It's very, very difficult to work it all out and try and fit whatever testimony that you consider to be correct into a pattern.
I think it was interesting.
It's a long time.
That Mr. Peachy, maybe you'd like to read the testimony or just discuss it, the hotel clerk. I think it was very interesting the way Senator Kennedy came down in a very small place, and the man didn't recognize him until he saw him on television as a senator. Bob thinks that there could have been a double.
The story that Kennedy gave, he says, "At this time I was very conscious of a throbbing headache, pains in my neck, a strain in my back. But what was even more conscious of is the tragedy and loss of a very devoted friend. Now, did you change your clothing? They're asking about what happened to him after he came back after the accident. This is early in the morning, Saturday. I was unable really to detect the amount of lapse of time, and I wanted to find out, and I put on some dry clothes that were there, a pants and shirt, and I opened the door, and I saw what I believed to be a tourist or someone standing under the light off the balcony and asked what time it was. He mentioned to me, I think, 2:30, and went back into the room. The story that Peachy, the innkeeper, says is entirely different. He indicates that a man came across the deck, walked down the stairs, and initiated the conversation, asking what time it was and about the noise that was going on next door at another party, and then went back upstairs again. And also, Peachy indicated that it was on the Sunday following the senator's Friday night TV appearance. On that Sunday, Peachy had a statement in the paper to the effect that it was not until Friday night that he knew that he was talking to the senator.
He had to sit on the television to know who the guest was.
He figured that because the senator mentioned it, that it was perfectly all right for him to mention it. And he had to realize that the senator must have been talking to him.
Yeah.
But he never positively identified the senator as being the person that came down the stairs, initiated the conversation, asked what time it was, which is an entirely different story from what the senator's inquest testimony is.
Yeah, there were so many discrepancies of everyone involved, all the witnesses in the cabin. We don't have time to go into all those discrepancies, but the thing that's so shocking to me is the handling of the law enforcement agencies when you get prominent people involved in these crimes or when they're murdered. All of a sudden, the efficiency, the law and order team of John Mitchell or J. Edgar Hoover or the local police fall apart. Edward Davis in Los Angeles and the Robert Kennedy murder. I want to go down there and give evidence on the Sirhan family and a conspiracy right after that murder. And they wouldn't listen to it. They said, you can come down. They said, no, we won't let you. If you weren't in the Ambassador Hotel, we're not taking any testimony. Mm. See, we won't go into it. Well, that really limits your audience, because then out of the Ambassador Hotel, they limit whether you stood on your right foot or your left foot. You know, and if you were in,
right.
And then they took the witnesses that stood on their left foot who had red hair. You see, that is the way they eliminated who they wanted to give evidence of what happened in the Ambassador Hotel.
Right.
And, you know, that right away makes you feel that you have to keep going farther into it, because you add up the discrepancies and you add up the lack of investigative procedure, and you come out with a conspiracy, in this case to discredit.
I think the best story about how the law enforcement agencies handled a particular case, let's say at Chappaquiddick on Martha's Vineyard. If you could read The Bridge of Chappaquiddick by Jack Olson, it's a very, very clearly done. He did a good lot of research on that.
Yeah.
And it's very clear, if you want to find out who was responsible for making the decisions having to do with the senator's charge, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good book, and you have a book coming out on the Chappaquiddick. You're trying to get
Hopefully,
a publisher now?
If we can find a publisher.
Oh, well, there's a publisher on
Maybe a West Coast publisher would like it. I don't think the East Coast publishers want to do anything about it.
They won't touch it?
They don't like to do anything about Kennedy.
A bookstore in town told me that there's a new book coming out about Ted Kennedy, and it's about his escapades with women and Jones drinking, and of course,
I'm sure this will not be published on the East Coast.
No, but again, it's to discredit any hopes of 72 in case he surfaces and begins to change his mind about.
So then you have to wonder who that publisher is.
Yeah, well, that publisher, he didn't have trouble getting a publisher. And
you mean the author?
The author, yeah, it's coming out to a big bookstore in town here. They're getting that book.
Likes to read about girls, I guess.
I know. I've asked them to carry serious books. Like Harold Weisberg's book, Frame Up, and Jim Garrison's book. Those books aren't on the stands.
I haven't seen them for a while.
No, it's hard to get booksellers.
You mean even on the West Coast?
Yes. It's hard to find truth even on the West Coast.
Yeah.
But they look for it a little more carefully. Jim Garrison's book is in paperback now, and somebody called me, it's at the Thrifty Drugstore. It's great because, you see, the book reviewers tried to put it down. It was a non-existing book. The bookstores wouldn't sell it. It's a well-written book, and the information does come out. So you will find, or you could get out like you did your last book, without a bound book. Can't you do a paperback kind of thing?
Right.
For the Chappaquiddick?
Hopefully. We've written 15 paperback publishers.
Uh-huh.
Just before I left East Coast, I wrote them. Yeah. Hopefully, by the time I get back, maybe I'll have an answer.
And then you get a book out on the Chappaquiddick affair. You, as I say, coming being in the West Coast, I had called Denise's office very early in the case. This was August the 8th. I called them several times.
The first That's time. The DA.
Yeah, the DA's office, uh-huh. And I had said, fingerprint the car. And then I wanted to know who, if anybody, saw Senator Kennedy wet at any time, in wet clothing. And I asked another question, how many doors were there to the cottage? Because I thought it was important. The way that the girl said they were lined up and that Kennedy sat in front of the house soaking wet and said, get me Markham. And I wanted to know who he said that to that came out and got Markham with him. If he didn't come to the house, they didn't see him wet. The fact in the middle of the night and that two people are gone and this girl's left her purse there and hasn't returned and somebody sits outside and sends for Markham, and then Markham and Gargan leave for a couple hours and supposedly diving in the water, and their hair's wet, and they come back, and nobody in that little cottage seems any interest or curiosity. Where is Mary? Or
Gargan's supposed to be all bloody from where he scraped himself on the inside of the car, too.
Diving
over
in.
His chest, his arms, and yet the next morning there is no question that he had any wounds or anything.
Nobody
talk about Band-Aids or blood or anything.
Little tiny wooden cottage, and the girls got up, and nobody had any inkling that anybody was dead or hurt or missing.
That's right.
And I wondered, you know, like, if any of the people involved in throwing that car over or helping in any way could have gone out of a back door. This is why I wanted to know if there was another door
in
the
cottage. I'm sure there's a back door. There has to be one, because the front door must have led right into the main room. We call it the living room. That always.
Yeah.
It would be very natural to have a little side door that would come into the kitchen.
Into the kitchen. And somebody could exit out that door and give the car a little push. They may not, but they could. I didn't know who was there. And it's easy to get a team of people to help if you can get so many hundreds into the Dealey Plaza that were part of the thing. You don't need someone actually from the cottage doing it, but because there was so much discrepancy in testimony.
The only reason I don't suspect, I've tried to suspect some of the members of the party, because that's the way you first go at things, you know, who was right there and who could know more than anybody else, except the people that were right there, is that they would have been then framing themselves and they would have had to live through the entire thing, and I think it's unnatural to me anyway, this is my feeling, that they would have framed themselves by asking themselves to go down there and get into a girly situation.
Well, they wouldn't frame themselves if you take a guy, say, who serves the beverages, if that person is responsible for making parties that you want to damage drowsy, like the doctor that gave Otto John, a prominent doctor in Germany, and well known, if he gives him something that makes him drowsy, it literally was discredit him. When Dr. Otto John was tried as a traitor, you know, for having gone to the Russian side and then finally escaping up back to Germany, the doctor would not testify anyway, because then he may be held in a conspiracy trial if he did indeed drug Otto John. But he knew that Reinhard Galen or the CIA or Adenauer or anybody else would protect him legally. He isn't endangering himself by administering any beverage, because he knows the law enforcement isn't going to prosecute him. He has that guarantee before he gets into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it works, because he did not have to testify. He said, I won't testify because then I'd be liable to conspiracy charge.
Well, you'd have to look at Crimmins then as being
the one
that you could.
Because
he says he went to sleep.
He says he went to sleep and he served the food. But I also, in when Ted Kennedy was asked about Mr. Crimmins, he was very vague about John Crimmins. You know, but did he usually drive for you? How often? And what? When did he serve you? What did he do? And his testimony was very vague about his position. He called him a driver. Crimmins called himself a private investigator. And I had called the East in asking who serves the drinks, because this is interesting. I called back East August the 8th, who serves the drinks? And the inquest wasn't published till what date? How late did that come out?
Oh, that was May.
In May,
May
the following
of
70. May of 70. Okay, yeah. August the 8th, 1969, I wanted to know.
That's very within 2 weeks of the accident.
That's right.
Right.
I wanted to know, were they drowsy? You know, because I had just finished the research on Otto John.
Hmm.
You see, and I can't say there is a parallel, but I, knowing they're common enemies, you can't afford not to go into it.
Right.
You see, and the fact that they don't makes me more convinced. Then I wondered about the concussion and how he got back to Edgartown. But if he left at 11, it could be hit. These are the things I was asking Denise back on August the 8th.
The origin wouldn't have anything to do with it, would he?
Well, I had a list of these questions, and when we got to the fourth question, the line was cut. The telephone line was cut. and I never could speak to his secretary or to him at any time.
Well, I called him within the last year, and he doesn't want to have anything to do with it.
No, nothing at all. They said you can't talk about it at all. It's over.
That's right. It's all finished.
It's all finished.
He finished it. It came out in the paper that he finished it, and that's it.
That's right. But that doesn't finish it for you and me.
No, that's just the beginning.
Now, you say the East Coast is pretty quiet about this assassination talk. They don't talk about like we're doing out here. Is there any way to generate an interest in the past political assassinations?
Well, my feeling is if you want to talk it on the air, you've got to get a hold of the director of the station and get him convinced.
Yeah.
That's a long initiation process.
I'll tell you one thing.
I don't happen to know any people that own stations.
I think there's a very encouraging thing, and this is like interdepartmental fights. This morning they interviewed Spiro Agnew about remarks in Life magazine that came out regarding President Kennedy.
Yeah.
And Spiro Agnew said that Life magazine implied they should be out of business, that they should follow the position of Look magazine.
That's very consistent with Vice President, isn't it?
What he said was that because they would carry the Irving story. He didn't go on to say that they canceled the story. Life hasn't published the account of Howard Hughes. They investigated and canceled it. They haven't put the whole book in that they were going to.
Not yet.
They've canceled. So he says anyone who did that, and they haven't done it. I mean, they investigated it because you said it's not right. So he felt they should be out. But you and I know, and when Richard Sprague was out here last week from the East Coast, we talked about a certain member of the staff of Life who quit there because he was doing research on the political assassinations, and they put the lid, don't go any further. And they have a lot of evidence locked up. And what they really do, they hold the power of the presidency of the United States in their files, the photographs. Don't you agree? Life magazine, on all of these murders, holds all the documentary evidence to prove a conspiracy. And if Spiro Agnew gets mean enough to Life, all they have to do is open the photographic lab. Don't say never. I mean, they could topple Spiro Agnew if they want to. But, you see, today he's going to get meaner, and the president's going to get mean. And Life holds the key to their power, and John Connolly's, too. And if they want to open those doors...
To show the film.
Then the radio stations in the East, like this one, when you have your evidence and documentation, and when it all falls out, you can get on the air back there and explain how it happened. Right. Because people will need explanations. They've all been lied to. Yeah. Well, I think it's great that you came out to the
Thank you
the
very
West
much
Coast
for having me, Maggie.
And I could meet you.
It.
It's good for the researchers to get together.
Okay, thank you, May, and Bob Cutler, to identify the voice once again from the East Coast, and Mae Russell, research specialist from here in Carmel. This has been Dialogue Assassination, and I'm Phil Kogan.
You've been listening to Dialogue. Dialogue is a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News.